Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, StubHub and blanket licenses for the internet. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music business news stories of the last week. A week when Warner officially launched its IPO.
Yeah, if you want shares in Warner Music, you need to go down the back of the sofa, get those coins together, because Warner Music Group is about to list on the NASDAQ stock exchange.
Yeah, they're selling 70 million shares, which sounds like a lot, although it is only 14% of the total company stock. But they are therefore going for a valuation of between $11.7 and $13.3 billion, which is quite a good return for Access Industries, which owns the company.
Yes, Access Industries, that's the they you were referring to when you were saying that they are putting 70 million shares onto NASDAQ and that they are looking for a valuation of the entire Warner Music Group of up to $13.3 billion. And the reason why that would be a good valuation is that when they bought the Warner Music Group back in 2011, at the record industry's lowest ebb, so assuming that you were an optimist in 2011 and you assumed that at some point the record industry was going to recover, which we're assuming that Access Industries and its boss Len Bavatnik was an optimist, and he was right to be optimistic because that $3.3 billion he paid for it in 2011, and yeah, going for a valuation of $13.3 billion on this NASDAQ listing. There having been rumours a couple of weeks ago that the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia were interested in getting some shares in the Warner Music Group, although we never quite got to the bottom of whether or not that was going to be as well as or instead of the IPO, or whether they were just going to try and grab some shares as part of the IPO. The latest rumour now is that Tencent, China's web giant, Tencent, having bought itself 10% of the Universal Music Group at the very end of last year, I mean, it led a consortium that bought 10% of the Universal Music Group at the end of last year, is now apparently going to try and get itself a slice of Warner Music as well through this IPO. So maybe we'll get to a point where, well, one of our predictions back in the day was that Tencent would ultimately buy Spotify. So perhaps eventually Tencent will own everything. It'll be easier, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
If there was just one company, yeah. One Chinese web giant that owned everything, then it wouldn't matter which streaming service people signed up with. It wouldn't matter which record company you signed to. It would all be the same thing. So it'll be interesting to watch whether or not those rumours come true. They were in the Wall Street Journal, so they're more reliable gossip mongers, aren't they? The Wall Street Journal.
I would say so.
Or would you be more prone to believe the gossip if it was coming from TMZ?
I think I'd take the Wall Street Journal first.
So yeah, Warner's IPO officially launched. That's all going to be happening. And once they are listed on the NASDAQ Stock Exchange, even though Access will still, you know, own much of the company, it will mean that we'll get more formal quarterly reporting from the Warner Music Group. I mean, actually, because they had various money lenders, they used to do quarterly reports anyway, but we should be getting more transparency on the business and where the money's coming in. I mean, A, we got a bunch of transparency by the prospectus that they published as part of formally launching the IPO, but we should start to get more detailed quarterly reports once they are listed. So if you're a fan of trade press reporting on quarterly reports, we quite often ignore those, don't we? The only quarterly reports I think we always mention, Spotify do subscriber updates, don't they, now, in their quarterly reports?
Yeah.
For investors, and that's always interesting to know. Whereas most other quarterly reports are just, we're doing great!
Yeah.
Record streaming income. It's like, well, of course there's record streaming income. The streaming market's in growth. Your streaming income's going to be higher. So actually, quite often, those quarterly reports are quite boring. So now we'll be getting more detailed, boring quarterly reports from Warner. So that's something to look forward to.
Yes, something to look forward to, but not something we are actually here to talk about this week, because this week we are actually going to be discussing all the many goings-on at StubHub in the last week and a proposal by the Electronic Frontier Foundation for a new blanket license to cover music across the whole internet. But first, let's get to all that StubHub business, starting with the resignation of President Sukhinder Singh Cassidy, who has announced that she is standing down from the company. Her departure comes as the ticket resale company deals with the impact of COVID-19, Although she insists that the business is now in a position to weather that storm, so she's leaving it in good condition as she departs, which is something she'd always planned to do anyway after the Viagogo acquisition.
Yes, so despite the optimism, more optimism, in the statements being put out by Cassidy as she confirmed her departure, of course we know, because we've talked about it on Setlist, we've written about it a lot in the CMU Daily, and if we're being honest, we're kind of stating the bleeding obvious. The entire ticketing sector, whether we're talking about primary ticketing or secondary ticketing, has been dealing with an immense challenge caused by the COVID-19 shutdown of live entertainment, as all of those ticketing companies have had to deal with an unprecedented, I know that's a bit of an overused word these days, isn't it? How long?
New normal.
How long can things be unprecedented before they actually become precedented? But an unprecedented number of cancellations and postponements within live entertainment, music, sport, theatre, etc., and therefore all the refunds that have had to be issued or reallocations of tickets to future events, a massive, massive challenge for all ticketing companies all over the world. Although I think it's probably fair to say that secondary ticketing companies like StubHub, so those companies which don't sell tickets on behalf of the promoters of shows, they are actually marketplaces where resellers or brokers, or what we would usually refer to as touts, or in the US we would call them scalpers, where those people who get tickets, usually hoovering them up from the primary market, then resell them on sites like StubHub. And in some ways, the challenges for the second ticketing sites are bigger than the challenges for the primary sites, because the minute tickets are going through a StubHub-style marketplace, there are more links in the chain. Because if the event is being cancelled and the promoter is refunding money, they would then pass the money to the primary ticket agent, who would then pass it to the seller, who would then pass it to StubHub, who would then refund the customer. And with all of those extra links in the chain, it just makes it more complicated. And of course, StubHub itself, whereas Ticketmaster can say, well, we're talking to the promoters, our client, and the promoter's going to do a refund, we'll sort all of that out. StubHub doesn't have a direct connection with the organisers of the events. So the entire ticket industry has been dealing with all of these challenges. But resale sites like StubHub and its new owner, Viagogo, have got extra challenges to deal with. And of course, there have been some specific controversies around what StubHub have been doing, particularly in North America, regarding its refund policies in the wake of COVID-19, because StubHub changed the terms of its much-plugged Fan Protect Guarantee Scheme that it usually has. So the Fan Protect Guarantee Scheme is the thing that sits on StubHub that says if you buy a ticket through the StubHub marketplace off a tout, don't worry, it won't be a dodgy tout. It won't be a ticket that won't get you into the show. The reason we can reassure you of that is if the ticket doesn't work, we'll refund you all of your money. That's the Fan Protect Guarantee. And because of the risks around ticket touting, the secondary sites make a much bigger deal about their money-back guarantee than, say, a Ticketmaster does. But in parts of the world, consumer rights law just says to StubHub, you've got to issue a cash refund if a show doesn't happen. But in countries, states and provinces where that isn't the law, including the US and Canada, StubHub changed the terms of its Fan Protect Guarantee Scheme so that, in a bunch of cases, people who had tickets to cancelled events can't get a cash refund. They have to accept a voucher. The voucher is worth 120% of whatever the ticket price was for the cancelled event, but nevertheless, in some places, StubHub is not allowing people to get a cash refund at the moment. They're forcing them to take a voucher, and that has proven controversial.
Yes, yeah, sufficiently controversial to result in litigation in, of course, the US first. As we've discussed in a previous episode of Setlist, StubHub was sued by a ticket buyer in the States who said that the company had changed the terms of its Fan Protect Guarantee after COVID-19 struck, so that unless local consumer rights laws said otherwise, as you mentioned, StubHub could force people with tickets to cancelled events to accept a voucher instead of money. Although, as you say, the voucher is often worth more than they spent on the ticket originally. They don't necessarily want a voucher for various reasons. You might have just gone off StubHub as a seller of tickets. You might need the cash quite urgently at the moment if you're struggling financially during this crisis. And so this ticket buyer sued over these alleged changes to the Fan Protect Guarantee. And then more recently, still in North America, but Canada this time, a Canadian law firm confirmed last week that it has also begun legal proceedings against StubHub on the same issue, although in the Canadian courts. Both lawsuits claim that the change to StubHub's Fan Protect scheme came on the 25th of March. And confirming its litigation in Canada, the law firm Kosky Minsky said it was launching a class action lawsuit on behalf of all persons resident in Canada who purchased one or more tickets from the defendants before 25th of March 2020 for an event that has been cancelled or is cancelled prior to certification of this claim, and who have not received a refund prior to certification of the class action. Oh, that's a long sentence. Lawyers do like long sentences, don't they?
They don't like commas.
They really don't.
If you read a lot of lawsuits like I do, you very quickly learn lawyers don't like commas.
Talking of lawyers, a partner at that firm, Kirk Bett, then added, StubHub has reneged on its promise to refund class members' money. This is obviously wrong and hurts everyday Canadians whose household budgets are stretched right now.
In addition to all of those lawsuits that are going on, which are not fun for StubHub, there's also been lots of speculation in some quarters that the company is struggling financially because of the refunds it's having to issue in those countries where it can't force customers to take vouchers and all of the other challenges that have come about because of the COVID-19 shutdown. There was even speculation that it could ultimately push the company into bankruptcy, although it has to be said that Cassidy, when talking to Billboard about her departure from the company, was keen to stress that those rumours were not true. And as you've already said, she insisted that the company was now in a position to weather the storm, although we do know that part of weathering the storm involved furloughing about 2/3 of the workforce, was what was being reported. And then last week, word came through that about 200 members of staff who had been furloughed have now been told that ultimately they won't have jobs to come back to. So a lot of furloughing and some quite significant downsizing going on in order to ensure that StubHub can weather the storm and that new owners via GoGo can come in and then run it beyond COVID-19 as a going concern.
Yeah, because before all the COVID-19 chaos kicked off, let's not forget that StubHub was bought by its rival Viagogo. And as I said at the beginning, she says it was always her plan to leave the combined Viagogo StubHub because they didn't need two bosses at one company. So she said, prior to the sale, we had agreed with Viagogo that I would be transitioning out at an appropriate time once the sale had been closed. And what more appropriate time than when everything's in complete chaos? Although she would say it's not.
Yeah, there's no chaos at StubHub anymore. They have weathered that storm, remember?
Oh, yeah, sorry, Koss. I forgot about all the storm weathering.
It's all about storm weathering.
It might look like chaos. It's not.
No chaos. To be fair, it's almost certainly true that it was her intent to leave once the Viagogo StubHub merger had completed, because that's what usually happens when two companies merge. So that does make sense. And the sale has completed. She's right in saying that. Although there is an added complication here, which is that the transaction is yet to be approved by the competition regulator here in the UK, because the Competition and Markets Authority has instigated a more in-depth investigation into this transaction, which means that the two companies can't actually formally merge in the UK. And as a result of that, they haven't properly merged globally. They're still operating as separate businesses. And I imagine for the Viagogo management team, it's kind of frustrating to watch this company you've just spent an awful lot of money buying going through a very difficult time because of COVID-19. And actually, you can't really step in and intervene because you've got to keep the separation, certainly in the UK, because your transaction is yet to get approval.
Yes, and talking of Viagogo's acquisition of StubHub, while we're being told from within StubHub that everything is fine, it's totally fine for the boss to step down at the moment because there's so much storm weathering going on. But this week, Forbes wrote an article about the acquisition headlined, "Worst Deal Ever." And that was based on the fact that Viagogo spent $4 billion buying StubHub just before the COVID-19 shutdown began, which is a lot of money to spend just before your entire industry closes, with people no longer buying tickets, and you faced with millions and millions of dollars in refunds to pay out, even if people do accept vouchers. So, hence that headline.
Yeah, that was quite an interesting article in Forbes, really putting the spotlight on this guy, Eric Baker, who was a co-founder of StubHub, then got pushed out of StubHub at about 2006 before eBay bought StubHub, moved to Europe, set up Viagogo as a competitor, and then last year, with this $4 billion that they seem to have sitting around, bought StubHub. So he was now back in charge of the two businesses that he'd founded, creating this ticket touting, secondary ticketing powerhouse, with Viagogo being a very significant player in places like Europe and Australia, and then StubHub being a much bigger deal in the US. But yeah, Forbes were basically saying, what a terribly timed deal to be spending $4 billion on a ticketing business just before ticketing stopped. And it was interesting, that article was calling this the worst deal ever, without even really considering what's been happening, certainly in Europe, but also in Australia and New Zealand and elsewhere, regarding secondary ticketing, regarding ticket touting. Because obviously here in the UK, we've seen a real shift in the attitude of politicians and lawmakers regarding the regulation of secondary ticketing and ticket touting. And we've seen laws being enforced. We've seen court cases where ticket touts have been found guilty. Similar things are happening elsewhere in Europe and in Australia and New Zealand. To date, less so in the US, although it's started to become a conversation in Washington as well. So I thought it was interesting that the Forbes article was calling this the worst deal ever, pretty much based on the COVID scenario, because obviously it was looking at it from a very US perspective. But looking at it from a global perspective, I would say that the challenges at the combined StubHub Viagogo, assuming ultimately they do get to properly merge with approval from the UK regulator, the challenges go beyond just dealing with the rest of the COVID-19 shutdown and coming out the other end of COVID-19 shutdown. There is also the challenges elsewhere in the world around the increased regulation of ticket touts and ticket scalpers, on which StubHub and Viagogo rely very heavily. So interesting times at both StubHub and its parent company, Viagogo.
Yeah, so as we said in the CME Daily last week, whether or not the combined StubHub Viagogo really can recover and thrive, which is another thing that Cassidy said StubHub would do post-COVID-19. It all sort of depends on how long the shutdown lasts for and how quickly the live sector can get back to normal. There's obviously different forecasts on that, some more pessimistic than others, although I think all quite pessimistic. But on top of that, there's also the outcome of those lawsuits over the company's refunds policy and whether that tighter regulation of ticket touting that we've seen in the UK and elsewhere expands into other markets, particularly the US.
Yeah, so interesting times ahead at StubHub and Viagogo as they weather the storm and, apparently, recover and thrive.
And finally this week, the writer, journalist and activist Cory Doctorow wrote an interesting article this week in his guise as special advisor to the Electronic Frontier Foundation. That's the American campaigning group that has frequently opposed the music industry's efforts to enforce and boost copyright in the digital age. But it was interesting because it was basically trying to appeal to artists and songwriters who think they don't earn enough from streaming and who feel that companies like Spotify are too powerful, but with a proposal the record companies and music publishers would really hate a blanket license, basically a compulsory license, covering all uses of music, songs and recordings online.
Yeah, so this blog post on the EFF website, which I think was in response to the Copyright Office's recent report on Safe Harbor and the other conversations going on about copyright and music and the internet in Congress. But it also kind of talks to the conversation going on in the artist community, particularly here in the UK, but also elsewhere, about how streaming money gets shared out. What we talked about at length on those recent editions of Setlist about concerns that not enough streaming money is going to artists and songwriters. And basically what he said in this blog post is that we, by that he meant the Electronic Frontier Foundation, we'd like to suggest that if Congress is going to be talking about music and copyright and the internet again, that rather than more fact-finding, where the facts are inevitably skewed towards the views of the finder, he wrote, that our legislators should instead start focusing on a concrete solution that builds on and learns from decades of copyright policy. And that is blanket licensing. Although I think he really means compulsory licensing, and they're not exactly the same thing. But basically, that is where anyone wanting to use music can go to a collecting society and get a single license that basically covers all songs and all recordings. So through one deal, one license, they can then use whatever music they like on whatever service they like and then pass money back to that society. The big difference between a compulsory license and a blanket license, although a compulsory license is also a blanket license, but a blanket license isn't necessarily a compulsory license. The compulsory bit is where copyright law says that songwriters and artists and labels and publishers are obliged to license through this system so that they can't say no. They can't say, I don't want my songs and recordings to be part of that blanket license. The law just says any music that's created will be covered by this blanket license administered by this collecting society. And as I say, he was basically saying there should be a compulsory license as well as a blanket license.
So for the uninitiated, people who don't know what he's talking about, he starts by saying, we all have lots of experience with blanket licensing, though we may not realise it, because this is what happens in pubs, bars, cafes, shops, etc. already. If you go into a shop and you hear some music playing, the shop hasn't gone and done individual deals on each track it plays. It has a license from the relevant collecting societies and it pays for that license, and then the money is shared out by the collecting society. So the shop can play pretty much whatever it wants. Dr. O also discusses how this same thing applies to music venues, and he talks about how this has been vital to the progress of music. He says it prevents the dominant music venues from becoming gatekeepers by insisting on exclusive access in exchange for playing publishers' leading tracks. If that happened, competitors without exclusive deals wither away or would never launch. But, he goes on, when the internet came along and Congress gave record labels a right to collect performance royalties, we lost sight of that principle of universal access. The only statutory licenses for recordings that cover internet services are narrow and full of limitations. The result is a toxic dynamic in which a handful of companies dominate online music services.
So it's an interesting blog, and we will link to it from the setlist notes, and we suggest that you read it. Although, of course, we have opinions about what he said. So we thought that we would spend the last bit of this edition of Setlist critiquing what he has said. So if we start off with those few quotes that you've just read out for us. So the reason why we have collective licensing and blanket licensing for things like shops, or he particularly focused on venues. So let's talk about venues. The fact that we have collective licensing for venues, it means that individual publishers can't say to a venue, if you don't play these songs, you can't get access to these songs. And that is true. That is one of the benefits of collective licensing. Although whether or not that's the motivation for collective licensing and blanket licensing, it is true that some compulsory licenses in some countries, so those are the licenses, as I say, which oblige copyright owners to allow people to use their music, usually at rates set in law. And the number of compulsory licenses varies from country to country greatly. In some countries, like the UK, there are none. And then in some other countries, there are quite a few. Compulsory licenses often cover things like radio. And there is sometimes a little bit of a freedom of expression element to compulsory licensing, that it's trying to balance free speech and freedom of expression with copyright. And an extent, I guess that's kind of what he's alluding to. And it is true, I think, one of the reasons why lots of artists and songwriters like collective licensing. I mean, when we, as part of the Digital Dollar Project with the Music Managers Forum, in the second year of that project, we did a whole load of round tables with artists and songwriters and labels and publishers and managers and lawyers, etc., etc. And artists and songwriters do like collective licensing. And one of the reasons they like it sort of is the reason that Dr. O is talking about here, which is that as a radio station, you don't play music for commercial reasons, because you've done a deal with this label that says you'll play this music, or maybe it's cheaper for you to air this music than it is that music. There's none of that in radio. You play music because you like it. And then artists and songwriters all earn the same based on how much their music's played. So when your music gets played on Radio 2, it doesn't matter if you are Ed Sheeran or Drake or some artist nobody's heard of, you're getting the same amount of money. So that is one of the benefits of collective licensing. Although whether or not it's the motivation for collective licensing, the reason it exists, is debatable. I mean, almost one of the reasons why collective licensing exists, and collective licensing exists way beyond compulsory licenses. I mean, actually, the way venues are licensed in the US through BMI and ASCAP, the collecting societies, that's not a compulsory license. And here in the UK, PRS, the same. Almost often, the reason why the music industry is choosing blanket licensing, choosing collective licensing, not being forced into it through compulsory licenses, is because it's just more convenient and easier. So the shops example that you gave, if every single shop had to do a deal with every single record company and every single music publisher and every artist and songwriter, well, clearly they wouldn't, because they don't need music that much. And it's quite complicated doing those deals. So either they would play no music, or they would play sort of Muzak type music, which they can buy from one company, or most likely they would just play music without a license, because realistically, nobody would sue them for that. So you know, for logistical reasons, it just makes sense where you have lots of people using lots of music, but actually those people don't have that much money to spend on music. It actually makes sense to license collectively with a blanket licensing system. So while it is true about some of the benefits of collective licensing, and those benefits are attractive, particularly to artists and songwriters, I don't know whether he's right about the motivations. When he specifically hones in on the recordings, of course, there is the irony under US copyright law. When it comes to recorded music being played in pubs, shops, bars, cafes, and even music venues, actually, there is no license for recordings because the sound recording copyright in the US doesn't include a general performing right. So no money is coming in on that side. But it is true that they added in the 90s this thing called the digital performance right. That's what he's alluding to when he says that although there is a compulsory license for digital services, it's a very narrow license. That is the Sound Exchange license, but it doesn't cover things like Spotify or Apple or YouTube or TikTok or anything like that. And really, the reason why that compulsory license exists is, well, first of all, this digital performance right was only added in the 90s. So it was a brand new right that the record industry was getting. And as a quid pro quo, Congress said, we'll give you this right. That's a gift. But in return, we're going to force a compulsory license on you, or statutory license, as it's sometimes called. But also, actually, really, that was to cover online radio and internet radio. And radio, not everywhere, but quite often is covered by a compulsory license. The fact that services like Pandora and the iHeartRadio service ended up being covered by that license, you could argue that wasn't really what Congress intended. There was a couple of test cases that confirmed that a Pandora-type service could use that license. But ultimately, that license was meant to be about online radio, which is why services like Spotify and Apple are not covered by the compulsory license that exists in the US. So, would agree with some of the things he wrote in those paragraphs, but not with all of them.
He then goes on to explain how this compulsory blanket license for all internet services would work, although he admits he does this in somewhat broad strokes because it's a blog post, not an academic paper. But he says, if you want to offer music to the public, if you want to start a streaming site or let users exchange music or share videos with music clips in them like TikTok users do, all you need to do is set up an account with a rights clearinghouse called a collecting society. You would pay the collecting society a monthly license fee that would go up based on the number of users you had. So the example he gives is if your service you were setting up had one user and Facebook has 2.5 billion users, then your license fee would be 1/2.5 billionth of Facebook's. From there, he says you would allow the collecting society to audit the use of music on your platform. They'd give you statistically rigorous sampling methods to assemble an accurate picture of which music is in use on your platform and how popular each track is. Then he says the collecting society will pay rights holders for your use of the music. That's it, more or less. It's not complicated, but it will be a challenge. There are lots of details we have to get right. I mean, one, I would dispute that it's not complicated. It's going to be very complicated, despite him laying it out in a few sentences. And he does admit that it will be a challenge to get it implemented. But I think he has not seen a lot of the challenges that will be faced in trying to implement something like this, not least the music industry that already exists.
Yeah, and I guess there's two elements to that. One is the huge opposition that will come from the music industry, although obviously he's addressing Congress here, and a change in copyright law could say, screw you, music industry, you have to do this. But there are other complexities as well. And actually, those digital dollar discussions I was talking about just now, which happened in the second year of the Digital Dollar Project with the Music Managers Forum. So when was that? I guess that's probably about 2016. And actually, this is one of the things that we talked about in those discussions, which is why did the record industry in particular, which is what this blog post is mainly about, but also actually increasingly the publishing side too, the song side too, why did they go for negotiating lots of direct deals with streaming services like Spotify rather than just running it all through the collective licensing system, rather than just having, so here in the UK, it would be PPL licensing on the recording side, PRS, MCPS licensing on the song side, and then labels and publishers wouldn't get involved in any of the deal making. They would just get their share of the money out of the system. And in some ways, it does sound simpler. And as I said before, what we confirmed with the various discussions we had back in 2016 is that artists and songwriters quite like collective licensing. And, you know, of course, under the current system, how much you earn when your music is streamed is slightly dependent on the deal that your label and your publisher has done with the streaming service. So, for example, on the song side, where co-ownership is quite common, it is conceivable that you could have two songwriters writing a song on a 50-50 split. That song then gets streamed. Spotify then pays out. But it might be that one of the songwriters is getting paid more than the other songwriters because of differences in the deal. And lots of artists and songwriters are like, that doesn't seem to make sense. You know, when your music gets streamed, everybody should get paid the same based on how much your music is streamed. And the only way we could achieve that is through a blanket licensing approach, a collective licensing approach. Now, whether or not that was achieved through compulsory license or through the music industry choosing to go this route, it could be either. Obviously, the music industry isn't going to choose to go this route. So it would have to be compulsory license. And a cynic would say, why don't the record industry want to go this route? Why have publishers increasingly, with Anglo-American repertoire, started to do direct deals rather than allowing the collective societies to do the deals? And you could be cynical, and actually, you're not even really being cynical, you're just being correct. The labels and publishers can get more money by doing direct deals. They can certainly get better upfront advances. And if you're going to try and negotiate equity into a service, you can do that through direct deals and you wouldn't be able to through a blanket license scenario. So, you know, we could be cynical and say the reason why the labels want to do this, the reason why the publishers want to do this is because they get more money. And that is definitely one of the reasons. And it has to be said that by going the direct deal route, publishers did get more money than they were getting through the collective licensing system. But there are other reasons, too, why this collective licensing approach, even though it does sound attractive, and on one level it does sound simple, there are complexities. And actually, probably the biggest complexity is that digital services are generally global. They operate in lots and lots of countries around the world, and ultimately they aspire to operate in every country. And the problem with collective licensing is it tends to operate on a country-by-country basis. And that's a problem on both sides, because it means that now Spotify has to go and get separate deals in every single country it operates with the collecting societies in those countries. But actually, it's even more of a problem the other way around, because it's like, okay, well, if I'm an artist, how do I get my money out of this system? Do I have to join every single collecting society in the world? So do I have to join 150 collecting societies to get my streaming money and then administrate 150 accounts? Now, okay, maybe the label and the publisher could take responsibility for that, and then the money flows through the label and publisher. Although another part of the plan, which we're going to come on to in a moment, means that really that couldn't happen. So are we saying that artists and songwriters now have to join 150 collecting societies? Now, of course, we know that the traditional collecting societies that collect money for radio and live, etc., around the world are all joined up through reciprocal agreement. So if you're a British songwriter or artist and your music gets played on a German radio station, the German collecting societies collect the money, pass it through the reciprocal agreement system to the UK societies that then pay the writers. And you could say, well, okay, why don't we just employ that system? And on the song side, some of the song rights are licensed through the collective licensing system with the money flowing around the world with those reciprocal agreements. So on the song side, some of that is already happening. But actually, there are all sorts of problems once money starts flowing around the world through the different collecting societies. For starters, there are plenty of collecting societies in the world which are inept. There are a few which are outright corrupt. Even where you've got societies who are decent societies, the minute stuff starts floating around the system, money gets lost, money gets delayed, there are data issues. So there are all sorts of issues with it because collective licensing tends to happen country by country and the services are global. Now, in this blog post, Dr. Rowe is proposing a new collecting society for digital, not using existing societies, a new society. So what if that society was global? But you know, a global collecting society would be sort of unprecedented. It is true that the European songwriting societies like PRS, etc., they are licensing services in multiple countries around the world. So they're sort of shifting towards a global licensing approach. But a truly global collecting society that could issue a blanket license, so a license covering all the music in the world, that would be unprecedented, to use that word again. And there would be issues with that. And of course, it has to be said that if this was being achieved through a compulsory license, through a statutory license, through copyright law, well, US copyright law can only make that happen within the US. So if we're relying on copyright law to make this happen, well, we're going to end up with national systems, so national societies, and then all of the challenges and issues that come with that. So while it probably is true that labels and publishers have gone the direct deal route in streaming because they can make more money and more upfront money, There are lots of complexities with shifting everything over to a collective licensing, blanket licensing approach, even if a compulsory license makes that happen. You also have the issue from the artist and songwriter perspective. He's trying to appeal to artists and songwriters in particular and basically screw the labels and publishers. But it has to be said that generally speaking, in most countries where there is a compulsory license, the rates go down. And where collective licensing is very tightly regulated, the rates go down. So, for example, the money you earn as a songwriter from live music and shows and tours in the US is much, much lower than it is in Europe. And that's because the law is intervening in the collective licensing process in the US in a way that it doesn't in Europe. So I think even though there are some ways in which he's trying to make this sound like it would be good for artists and songwriters, what labels and publishers would say to artists and songwriters is compulsory licensing always results in us getting less money. So you don't want to support this.
But he's still trying to make this attractive to artists by saying that even if rates did go down, they would get more money because the law would stipulate what cut they received and what amount of money they received from plays of their music. So he writes, artists have long railed against online music distributors like Pandora and Spotify, saying that they receive inadequate compensation for the use of their work. The streaming companies counter by opening their books and showing that they've paid out billions in license fees. Can both sides be right? Indeed they can. If almost all the streaming money is hoarded by the labels who get to arm twist musicians into one-sided contracts, it's entirely possible for Spotify and Pandora to spend billions to license music while the musicians get next to nothing. Statutorily guaranteeing that, at a minimum, half of all license payments go to artists irrespective of their label contracts is a way to ensure that online music listeners and online music makers are on the same side, and the more people love a musician's art, the more money the musician makes.
So what he's getting at there is that with the compulsory license that does exist for online radio, which, as I said before, would also cover personalised radio services like Pandora and iHeart, with that compulsory license, the money gets split 50-50 between artist and copyright owner. Obviously, a self-releasing artist are the same thing, but let's assume the artist is working with a label. That means the money that comes through Sound Exchange, half of it is paid to the copyright owner, usually a label, and then the other half goes directly to the artist. It doesn't even go through the label's bank account. Now, that is the performer equitable remuneration system that we have in most countries for things like radio and public performance, etc. Actually, in the US, because as I've already said, there are no royalties coming in from pubs, clubs, bars, cafes, or even AM/FM radio because of a quirk in American copyright law, in the US, that equitable remuneration only applies to online radio and to personalised radio, whereas in the UK and in most other countries, it applies to all sorts of radio. And so that's what we often refer to as performer ER. And the debate as to whether or not performer ER should be paid on streams has been going on for years. And the recent fixed streaming, broken record conversations and the new campaign that we've got here in the UK from the Musicians Union and the Ivors Academy around how the digital pie gets shared out, which we talked about in great detail in those recent special editions. ER is part of that conversation, is one way of ensuring that artists, particularly heritage artists and session musicians, get a bigger cut of streaming money, or in the case of session musicians, any cut, should there be ER on streams. And the argument goes, well, streaming feels more like radio than it does selling a CD. There's ER on radio, so we should have ER on streams as well. And that's part of this proposal here as well. We go over to a compulsory license, a blanket license across all digital services. We'd have the same ER system. The money gets split 50-50. Half goes to the copyright owner, the label, half to the artists. Hey, artists, at a stroke, even if ultimately, I mean, he's not saying this, but even if ultimately less money is coming in because compulsory license often sends the rate down, you would be getting 50% of the money, whereas a lot of you who are on traditional record deals are probably getting at most 20% of the money, so you would be quids in, which is why you should support this, is what he is saying. And as I say, there are plenty of artists and managers of artists who do think that there should be ER on streams. It's another thing we've discussed in great detail as part of the Digital Dollar Project. The question is, what do we mean by ER on streams? Are we literally saying a 50-50 split? If we are, pretty much every record company will tell you that that is unsustainable. And I'm not just talking about the major labels here. I'm talking about the cuddly, friendly, most artist-centric indie labels out there. The vast majority of them will tell you if you were to go over to a 50-50 ER system on streams, on the single biggest revenue stream for the record industry, record companies would be screwed, is what labels tell you. Now, you can decide for yourself whether or not you want to believe them, but it's all labels. It's not just the majors who are saying a 50-50 ER system can't work. There are compromises there. So some people have said, well, we're not talking about a 50-50 split like on radio. We're saying that a smaller percentage should go directly to artists through ER. Some people also say maybe if it's an on-demand stream, there's no ER, but if actually if it's delivered through a playlist, there should be. So there's some extra nuances to the debate there as well. Whether or not the only way to get ER is through a blanket license, a compulsory license, a statutory license, like it's been proposed in this blog, I would say not, but although it does depend on how ER has been implemented in each country. So although this ER concept exists in most countries in copyright law, how it is implemented differs around the world. And in some countries, you could almost say the minute you start talking about ER, you're talking about compulsory licensing. It's the only way you can make it work. Actually, here in the UK, that's not the case. You could carry on having the labels doing the direct deals. It's just that as the money comes in, before the labels get the money, it would flow through another entity, which would then grab a portion of the money for the artists, probably then pay it to PPL, and then the artists will get their ER through PPL. So actually, certainly under the UK system, you could set up ER for streams without having to go down the compulsory license route. And I think in the US, you could do that as well. But maybe in some countries, it's not quite that simple. But I do think that the ER conversation and the compulsory license conversation do not have to be the same thing. So you could be saying, as some artists are, there should be some ER on streams without proposing that we go the blanket license, compulsory license route. So there might be a way of getting artists a bigger guaranteed cut of streaming money without following the proposal in this blog. Also, the other issue is with ER, assuming that money ultimately gets to artists through a collecting society, even if we were still doing direct deals in streaming, a society would almost certainly have to handle the ER money. And again, we end up in the same issue of, well, collective licensing tends to work on a country-by-country basis, digital services are global, would money just get stuck in the system and lost in the system and actually artists not benefit? But, as I say, it does depend slightly on the copyright law of each country, but I think there are ways that you could get ER on streams without having to go for the somewhat radical proposal in this blog post. The last thing I would say about this is it's definitely worth a read. The labels and publishers would vehemently oppose it, and they would argue to artists and songwriters that it's not in their interest either, and for all the reasons I've set out today, in some ways they would be right to say that. The one thing I would throw in, I know I say this all the time, is assuming the music community ultimately is united, so artists and songwriters as well as labels and publishers, on not wanting compulsory licensing or blanket licensing in the streaming space. The big argument in favour of compulsory licence, which is basically what the EFF are saying, is music licensing is too complicated. It's impossible to license a service. That's why we have so few services in the marketplace, so the only solution is compulsory licensing. Well, the other solution is better music licensing, better systems for licensing music. Actually, I would argue most of the problems are on the song side, not the recording side. But we could still make it easier across the board for new services to license music, for new services to get maybe test licenses where they can experiment with a service before actually going properly live. And the other thing which I always come back to is one of the strong arguments in favour of compulsory license is music rights data is such a mess. That's what makes music licensing a nightmare. That's what makes getting people paid a nightmare. Therefore, the only solution is a compulsory license. And actually, at one point when the copyright directive was being negotiated in Europe last year, and it was clear that there were going to be new liabilities for websites like YouTube, at one point they almost tried this ruse, which was basically to say, if you're going to give us more liabilities as a user upload website, the only way that can work is if we get a compulsory license, a bit like the one being described in this blog post. Now, that wasn't seriously considered in Europe, but that was almost YouTube kind of saying, well, if you're going to give us more liabilities, your music licensing systems, your music data systems are so screwed up that the only solution is compulsory license. Well, the other solution is a better music licensing system and decent music rights data. And the reason why I bring that up is, I mean, who knows whether or not anybody in Washington will pay any attention to this blog post, whether or not the tech companies that in some ways EFF is speaking for will get behind this proposal as the copyright conversation evolves in the US. But getting better music licensing systems in place, getting better music data in place will always help the music industry fight proposals like this, assuming that the music community is united and wants to get involved in that fight.
Yeah, so as you said earlier, we will link to that blog post in the notes for this episode of the show. If you go to setlistpodcast.com, you will find them there, plus links to everything else we've discussed in this episode, and probably some stuff that we haven't as well, because just like to throw it all in there. That makes it sound like it's less organised than it is. Very organised. A very good list of links that actually in your podcast player you might have access to as well, depending on what app you're currently using. But that's all we've got time for on this episode of Setlist. Don't forget to subscribe in that podcast app I just mentioned. Press any sort of like or rating button. That would be great too. And maybe even write us a review or tell a friend. We can shout it from the rooftops. If, both of us, we're both doing this in attics. So once I've turned off the recorder, I'm going to open the window. I'm going to shout it out the window. Don't you think I won't? But yeah, that's all we've got time for this week. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.